Heyo! Welcome back to We Talk Comics. I think we're on episode number 35 now, hopefully. We took a week off for a special edition, our interview with Malibu Comics editor-in-chief Chris Alm, as well as publisher and co-founder Dave Albrecht. But we are back with our whole crew, and I am Mo, your master, your crown prince of charisma. Let's call him that. Mo, M-O underscore We Talk, or Mo at We Talk Podcast. And I have with me our, I guess he could be the jack of hearts. He's certainly the jack of all trades, if not a redheaded stepchild. And that's Brett. Brett, how are you doing?
I think I'm okay, though I haven't been redheaded for quite a while, but that's all right.
You always will be to me. And of course, we also have with us our, I could make a joke here that he's the queen or the Joker or something like that, but I won't because he is our very own award-winning investigative journalist. And that, of course, is Keith. How are you doing?
Doing great, Mo. Ready to talk some comics. It feels like ages since we did a regular episode.
And, of course, that leaves the final member of the podcast, our king of beers and B-movies, the one and only Chris. Chris, how are you?
My crotch is pretty itchy right now.
And that's a wrap, folks.
There's an app for that.
Is it by Appy Entertainment?
It is.
And there we go. Bring in that we want those guys associated with us. So we're gonna move on. But thank you everybody again for joining us. This is We Talk Comics. Of course, this is the 90s part 2, Death, Nightfalls, and Crossover Craziness. So we are back again to talk about that. But first off, we got to do the news. There's more than just a little bit. But of course, if we're going to do the news, we have to talk about our sponsor. Chris, what do you think of Comicosity?
Comicosity is my favorite comic news site on the net. I visit it at least twice a day. It is the go-to site on the net for comic books. Don't be a geek. Be a comic geek. Visit Comicosity.
That's right. You go there for, you love the news? How about the previews?
I hate the previews. Sucky is part of the site. But that's only because my good friends, Brett and Keith, review there. I've already heard them by the time they get there.
I was good. I say previews, not work with me here, Chris. Previews, not reviews. You like the previews?
I love the previews.
How about the reviews? Some by our very own co-hosts, Brett and Keith.
They suck.
How about the reviews by everybody else?
Love the reviews by everybody else.
How about the features, the special articles?
I only like them when I'm in them.
There you go. Nevertheless, Comicosity, Chris was right. Don't be a geek. Be a comic book geek. Visit our pals over there for the best layout, most easy to navigate, funnest and best run website for comic books on the internet. And we are off to do the weekly news with Cub Reporter K.
Well, having been off last week, there is a crazy amount of news. And some of it will be a little old news to our listeners, but our opinions are brand new. Since our last episode was the Malibu episode, I'm going to start off with news from our pal Longbox Graveyard, who will be hosting a panel, a Malibu retrospective panel at San Diego Comic-Con. And Chris Ohm and Dave Ulbrich will be there, Tom Mason will be there, and Scott Rosenberg. And that's on the Thursday of San Diego. I cannot wait. I get to meet these guys in person after spending all this time talking to them via the internet for our specials that we've done with these guys.
And I'm really just going to jump in here. They're great guys. We're just going to jump in here. Our friend Paul Longbox Graveyard. We're going to have a little more coming from him, I believe, on this website soon. So that's just a little tease. The big announcement isn't ready yet, but that's just a little tease.
It comes in it'll be in the upfronts. Do we do upfronts?
We are now.
I believe he teased it on Twitter as well. So
follow him on Twitter. And follow us on Twitter.
I'm the only one actually gave his Twitter.
Well, everyone knows that I am Cub Reporter K on Twitter.
There you go.
All right, and Mike Allred will finally accomplish one of his life goals, one of his childhood dreams. Having talked on Twitter and in various forms about how much he's enjoying Mark Waid's run on Daredevil. He has been invited to be the artist on Daredevil number 17.
Sweet.
Still written by Waid. Yeah, so it presumably a done and one, but quite a cool idea.
Or a one and done.
Or one and done. I don't think that's a thing, but yes.
A one and done, not a done and one.
Done and one, I think, is the phrase. Now you've got me questioning whether
one
that's
and
actually
done?
The phrase.
I've only heard one and done, usually.
Really?
Done in one is the way I'd go with it.
Mm,
well, okay. Now we're going to have to contact Paul in order to give us a bit to break this. So anyways, Longbox Graveyard. Oh, well, whatever. Hey, anyway, let's go.
All right. Through John Byrne's website, Byrne Robotics, in the forums, we found out that John Byrne had been offered a cover for Before Watchmen and declined. Now, this was a big headline on, I'll say, one of the gossip sites. If you actually read what was in the forums, he just wasn't interested in working for DC. It was no big statement on anything. But interesting how they did cast quite a wide net for who would be doing the alternate covers and such for Before Watchmen, which are only days away. The first one comes out on the 6th of June, counting down.
I guess we'll have to review those.
Well, three of us can review them, and you can just, you know, sit angrily.
Yeah, grr, that's what I do.
I know. Yeah. I know. Longbox was saying he was going into a media blackout. He wants to know nothing about them. No interest. So we'll have a lot of varied views as we hit that first issue of Minutemen next week.
Yeah, Paul's right. Official review is that he hates it.
That's right.
That's
he's
my official.
He's written it already.
Yeah.
Hated it.
Especially hated page 6. Page 6 was where it all. Page five, I was starting to wonder maybe it would be okay, and then page 6, that's where it all turned around, and yeah, I was right all along, page 6.
Now I don't have to bother reviewing any other books this week.
Exactly.
Copy and paste.
Dan Slott, writer of Amazing Spider-Man, is moving to everything, all the chess pieces towards something happening at issue 700, which will come out around the end of the year. Amazing Spider-Man, as you know, publishes 6 times a week with a different artist every 4 pages or something like that. What he said is that he said in an interview, this is my biggest whack at the comic book pinata, that it is something seismic. Marvel's not doing a reboot, he says. But after the events of Amazing Spider-Man number 700 and the final events of AVX, there will be a very different landscape to Marvel by the end of the year.
So let me make a guess. Issue 700, Aunt May dies.
I was going to guess the exact same thing.
Wait, wasn't that issue 400?
I'm
yes.
Gonna, I
and
believe
5.
And 5? Yeah.
No, I don't know. But...
Wait 1 second. Just a question here. Was that 20 years ago issue 400 was? And now it took 30 years to get to 400, and it's taken 20 to get to 300, another additional 300. Is that correct?
Well, as I said, it publishes every 4 hours. in print, it comes. There's both a morning and an evening edition of Amazing Spider-Man now.
Wow.
All right, they take Sundays off, though. Otherwise, they would have been in 700 already.
Oh, well, they're just lazy slackers.
We've heard all kinds of rumors that this could be as big as Uncle Ben coming back to life. Like crazy stuff we're hearing. I wouldn't be, if it's Aunt May as Spider-Man at this point, I don't know if I'd be surprised. And what else do we got happening here? DC also still being cagey as to what's coming up here in September. We will know hopefully by the next episode. I was hoping that we'd know by this episode. Because the DC solicits for September are due around a week and a half away, a little less than 2 weeks away. The 31st of May was the anniversary of the announcement of the New 52, 11 days before the solicits came out for September.
I know what it is. I can break it right here on the show if you want.
All right. Yeah, I want
all right.
you to.
All right. What they're going to do is they're going to wipe the whole universe off again and start at number one more time. And this time, do it to not piss me off. This time, do it well. All 52 will be good. Going to bring back all my characters the way I want them. That's what they're doing. They're going to say this last joke. What they're doing is they're pulling a, what it was, a Dallas, where the whole year was a dream. That's what they're doing.
Mo apparently writes every 52 book now.
I pitched on Twitter
today. What Dallas did. Last year, that was just a joke. That was just a dream. We're screwing with you.
I pitched on Twitter that what they're going to do is relaunch everything at number one and call it the old 52. And it's every top-selling book they've ever done. So the JLI will be Keith Giffen, DeMatteis doing JLI.
That would rule. Dude.
Grant Morrison on Justice League.
I am in.
Dan Shurgens on Superman. Oh, wait. Dan Shurgens is already on Superman. Well, no change there.
Oh, I'm in.
Yeah, Alan Moore's on The Watchmen.
Scott Snyder's on his college paper. Well, there's a couple of interesting things. I mean, as with last year, August is a five-week month, the five-Wednesday month. So the final, August 29, is a fifth week and doesn't have any regular issues. It actually has four annuals come out that day. Justice League International, as we've said, is the final issue of the Justice League International series. That's in the annual that comes out that day. The Superman annual that comes out that day teases that he gets help from a brand new Green Lantern. And the Green Lantern annual that comes out that day has a Green Lantern logo kind of dripping, very much evoking the Death of Superman logo of the dripping S. And the only thing in the sales pitch was, everything changes here, everything. Which really reminds me of the tagline of Flashpoint last year was, everything changes in a flash. So something's coming, and I'm hoping that by next week we'll be able to take a look at what that something is and the shockwaves that come out of it.
No buys. Anybody have any excitement over that? I don't.
Old 52. It's just going to say that everything from 0 hour on. Just wipe out 16 years of continuity.
Some of that 0 hour is crap, so let's not go too far here.
Everything post-crisis. That seems to be the way they're going anyway. Crisis gets undone.
There you go.
Infinity Inc.'s back. Everyone's happy. Movie news. So, G.I. Joe 2 has been delayed till March of 2013.
I know, that sucks.
For reasons that are a bit vague. Something to do with 3D is the official story. I believe the official story was 3D. We've also heard rumors that it has to do with Channing Tatum and wanting to shoot new scenes with him because it didn't test well that he wasn't in that much of the movie.
All I know is that means The Rock isn't coming back to Russell till later, which is what pisses me off about it because I won't see the movie.
Well, it's created a couple of oddities. One is that the comic book prelude is already running, and I guess we'll be in trade paperback by the time the film actually comes out. And the action figures are on the shelves in places for a movie that's not out for another almost a year.
It's called a tease.
It's called a complete failure of vertical integration is what that is. But that's...
At least the comic book is a prelude and not an adaptation of the movie.
Oh, man. Now there will be a complete failure, I guess.
Yeah, that would be in the epic scale.
Yeah,
I don't know. When's the novel coming out?
Yeah. By Max Allen Collins?
There'll be a novelization by either Peter David or Max Allen Collins.
Yeah.
That's a flip of the coin right there.
I'll check their official websites right now.
More movie news. The next, after the Superman... Oh, I've blanked on it already. The Superman animated that's coming up. So Superman's the next one coming out, and then after that it will be followed by an animated adaptation of Dark Knight Returns.
No.
No nuance to that. No. absolutely no nuance to that. Just
finally, DC's doing something that pisses me off.
Should we just move to random grunting out of moments? Then?
It'll be for the first time a two-part direct-to-DVD. The first part coming out in the fall of 2012, and the second part coming out in early 2013, with Bruce Wayne, the Batman of Dark Knight Returns, voiced by Peter Weller.
Good to see he's working.
Well, or possibly literally phoning it in.
Literally phoning it in. Yeah, you know what? I'm not into that. Year One is my favorite Batman story. But I didn't mind Year One being done because it just doesn't have that same legendary status, that groundbreaking status. That said, DC will most likely do a very good job because they almost always do. That's my editorial. I don't want to see it. You all right, next news item. Come on, let's go. Let's go. We got a lot to talk about here.
We've also got release date estimates for a couple of comic book, well, one comic book movie and one that's just, you know, close to my heart. X-Men First Class, the sequel, July of 2014, and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, May of 2014.
Has that Spider-Man movie come out yet?
Amazing Spider-Man is out in July.
Oh, okay. See, I had no idea when it was coming out.
All right. North Star's getting married. This caused some kerfuffle last week. The announcement that...
Wait a second. Who's North Star? I don't know that guy.
You need it there. That's
and he doesn't know you either.
that's Mo plugging my award-nominated... Because I'm mailing in the nomination any day now. My award-nominated blog for WeTalkPodcast.com. North Star doesn't know who you are either. And which is an op-ed on the reaction that some had to the announcement that North Star, formerly of Alpha Flight, currently of the Astonishing X-Men, who has appeared 800 times in his history, first one being an Uncanny X-Men, so a little tiny title that was the number one book at the time, is getting married next month. And this is a story because...
What's her name?
Well... Therein lies the tale, Mo.
We're having fun, folks. We hope you are, too.
So North Star will be getting married in the first same-sex marriage in Marvel Comics. And this happened to come at the same time that Dan DiDio, who was at KapowCon, was asked a question about the increased diversity of the New 52, and someone said, well, why haven't you introduced a new gay character if you're going to be diverse? And in answer, he said, well, we're just about to. It'll be next month. That was the level of announcement, and then it went crazy. The only details that came out right away were it will be a major character who has not appeared in the New 52 thus far, so despite all of the rumors that immediately happened, even knowing that it was everyone from Batman to Tim Drake to
Booster Gold.
They had said right away, I still theorized that it was going to be Tim Drake, but because I think that would be who I'd choose. So what we know for sure is, has not appeared in the New 52, but that may mean has not appeared in costume. There's some vagueness there. It is a major character. They are iconic, is something that I believe it was Scott Snyder had said on his, because he was asked immediately if it was Bruce Wayne. It is not. It is not one of it's not one of the Trinity. It's not one of the big characters that has already been introduced. But it will be a prominent character, and they refer to it as the most prominent gay character that they have ever had in DC. Obviously, they've had characters going back 20 years. Pied Piper was the first in either Marvel or DC to be an out character. North Star soon following. So those are the clues, and they'll debut in June, which kind of starts limiting the options.
What is the leading candidate that seems to be...
the prevailing wisdom and what the gossip sites are reporting is Alan Scott in Earth 2, number 2. He did appear in a couple pages, but not in costume.
Okay.
My money's on Wally West, though.
That would be quite a twist to bring in Wally West all of a sudden. And
I really don't believe it's Wally West. Now, what
I was hoping for Plastic Man.
Plastic Man came out a long time ago. He's not an iconic character.
He's iconic, but he hasn't been introduced in the New 52. He's been mentioned, but he hasn't actually been in it.
Now, Alan Scott has, Obsidian. Is that the name of his son? Is that right?
Was his son, but remember that all the JSA are being de-aged for Earth 2.
That's true, and as well. So
as
Jade
well,
also does not exist.
And
his daughter Jade. He still could, yes, but I'm just saying.
He could very well have kids, but I mean, realistically, because they've de-aged the JSA, he may have kids, but you know, he's not having grown kids, that's for sure.
Or these characters might be introduced still into the universe, but not as his children, because they're not going to throw those characters out, though, just because the Alan Scott necessarily won't be their father. They'll still, Obsidian and Jade will still show up, because they don't get rid of characters. They find a way to use them.
Well, and it might be interesting to have them be, you know, the idea of Infinity Inc. was contemporary characters that were the children of the World War II characters.
Reed not as good.
And if the Justice Society characters are now current, you could still do Infinity Inc. from 20 years in our future, which, you know, may be an interesting way to bring those characters in. I mean, it'd be kind of, if Alan Scott is the gay character, it might be a cool moment of, you know, Obsidian and Jake going turning up and like, where are your kids? You're my what now? okay.
I like that. That's good. What else you got there?
Well, one last story. We'll be getting to Kickstarter and stuff in a couple of episodes in more depth, but because this Kickstarter funded so quickly, I didn't want to save it for that episode. Dave Sim, with some help from people who actually own a computer, has started a Kickstarter for Cerebus High Society Special Audio-Visual Digital Edition. Now, what he's set up is that he wants to digitize Cerebus High Society, which is, looking at my shelf, Volume 2 of the Cerebus collection, and not only digitize the comic, but an audio-visual version in which he will do an audio commentary, essentially. And it's just been announced that his ex-wife will be doing her editorials as well, reading those text pieces as part of the package. Now, this was supported really quickly by Colleen Duran and Kurt Busick, amongst others. And they had set a goal of $6,000 for the Kickstarter program. They met it in 9 hours. And as of our recording right now, they are at $22,988 raised. Dave said already that anything they put in excess would go to more bells and whistles to the digital project and to transferring turning the entire Cerebus story into this audio-visual digital edition, as they're calling it.
I think that's a great idea. I'm curious. I hope other people follow suit, but it does have potential to be boring.
Well, it's an interesting concept. I got to be honest. I didn't watch his trailer. I just backed it. I threw down a few bucks. I'm such a fan of Cerebus, having read the entire series. And there were really interesting bonuses, as always, with a good Kickstarter, starting from, you know, $1, which he just says thanks, to $5, where they put you on the thank you page on the Dave Sim Arts website. Going through signed World Tour book, the Zero issue, alternate covers, a few odds and ends, Diamondback cards, portfolios, as you go up through the different values. At $500, you get a half-hour phone call with Dave Sim. to just chat about whatever you want to chat about. And the top thing that has not yet been claimed, for $10,000, Dave Sim will come to you. You put him up in a hotel, and he will paint a mural of Cerebus on the wall of your house.
Now, I wonder how much we'd have to pay to get him on this podcast as an interview. I wonder
if he'd allow us $500.
I wonder if he'd allow, but yeah, but I wonder if he'd allow us to put it on, to talk with him. If we got
I've seen people on Twitter taking a look. Maybe we should start our own Kickstarter
to get money to give to him. Have him on the I like
it. We're looking for $1,000 to pay for Dave Sim to come onto our podcast.
That's awesome. Extra money will go to Bells and Whistles of beer and pizza with me, for me and Chris.
If we get to $1,005, we can get Mulvey on.
Awesome. All right, anything else?
And that's the news.
Awesome. All right, that was a fun news section. A lot to go through, but a great time. So anybody else like me want to talk some comics? Anybody in the mood?
Yeah. Yep.
All right, well,
let's talk some comics.
Well, basically, when we left off last time talking about the 90s, what we had going on was we were kind of at the point where we were just about to get into the death of Superman. Kind of we had built up to that point. But the thing is, we hadn't really talked about Malibu because we knew Malibu was coming with an entire interview. And that interview had a lot more than Malibu in it. It had early days of Malibu, but a lot of talk about Marvel, a lot of talk about Image, a lot of other stuff that was related to it. And for me, a lot of stuff I didn't know, and I don't think was public knowledge anywhere. I think somebody needs to update the Wikipedia sites for Malibu and Image based on our show. So I want to know, just Keith, what did you learn or what surprised you that you didn't know in that interview that kind of caught you off guard talking about the 90s and Malibu?
Well, it was great to hear so much insider information and, you know, just from the little the first day that Malibu was thought of as a concept, you know, through to the end. But probably the moment, you know, as we were recording it, they were talking, and Mo and I just looked at each other when they were talking about the possible DC takeover of Malibu, that, you know, Mo mouthed to me, "Did you know anything about this?" Like, "No, I don't know. I have no idea. I hope you keep talking." It was such a surprise, and the detail of that section of the takeover by Marvel, etc., and what went into that, it was so different than how it's represented in articles that I've read. I mean, everything is kind of simplified as Marvel wanted the coloring system. And these guys were on the inside. That just wasn't the reality. It was much more complicated than that. It was so fascinating for me to, you know, get that amount of information that just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, you know what? I remember reading, I believe really where I found out about the details of Malibu's purchase to Marvel was through Wizard magazine at the time. And Wizard never mentioned DC, at least to my recollection, and they talked about the coloring system being a big reason why it was purchased. And now we found out that, like you say, that was only a small bit. Brett, anything that you learned that surprised you?
Well, I think one of the number one things that I learned was the concept of why the Malibu characters just don't really exist in the Marvel Universe anymore. I like the knowledge that the concept of path of least resistance to whichever characters they're going to use, I think that opens up a whole lot of answers for why a lot of characters don't get used. Not just the Marvel characters. It's just that, like, oh, I understand something about the comic industry as a whole because of that.
Yeah, I know. It was great, great stuff. We really appreciate those guys coming on. Chris, did you have anything you learned, or you want to react to anything that they just said?
Yeah, actually, the DC thing does shed a lot of light on why the Marvel purchase didn't work. It was fairly obvious in the interview that Marvel was reacting and not acting, and maybe that takeover wasn't as well planned as it could have been, thus explaining its ultimate failure. Also in the interview, I have to say, I just love listening to these guys talk comics. It's obviously they love the comic books as much as we do. I just wish that they were still in the industry and running a comic book publisher, because they were obviously fairly successful. It wasn't a failure of Malibu or anything else. It was just market pressures that forced Malibu to become a non-entity.
Keith, that's
we
up
have
there.
Today.
Keith.
It was really, I mean, it's the way that Brett Moe and I talk when we talk about, you know, running comic stores, even though that was, you know, now quite a small percentage of my life was spent running a comic store, but it's still a time that I talk of with that kind of joy. And I mean, these guys sounded like they had a one-hit wonder band when they were in their 20s or something. That's the kind of love that they talk about. Their lives have changed. That's not what they do. They've gone on to other things. But certainly, I mean, fond memories. And I know that Paul tweeted us after that sent us an email that they had gone out for dinner afterwards, still telling stories. And so great that they had such a
likely beer and Mexican food.
Beer and Mexican food is probably what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I asked because Chris and Dave aren't on Twitter, and Paul told me if they were, they would tell us how much they enjoyed that. And I said to him that I wish there was something. I said, I wish I'd asked them more about DC. I wish I'd asked them if, in hindsight, they wish that purchase had gone through instead. And he said he was pretty sure if DC had purchased Malibu, they'd still be running the business today and Malibu would still exist. That Marvel simply didn't have a plan. And I thought that was also something that's inside information that's kind of interesting. So, great stuff. So let's move on to the death of Superman. Keith, we're going to jump to you. The death of Superman. Go.
The death of
1992,
Superman.
Or what, 1993? 1993, was it?
The end of 1992. The very tail end of 1992, I believe.
Brett, by the way, his cat is 10 times crazier than your cat.
My cat is too old to be crazy.
He is currently wearing his cat as a hat because he is not paying attention to the cat. Go ahead.
My cat's way too old for that. Death of Superman, I know some people don't look back on it fondly. I know that Wiener had Landis had done that thing on that hate thing on Death of Superman, which was incredibly timely to do it 20 years after it happened. Congratulations, you hated a story 20 years ago. That was my honest reaction to that video. I didn't polish that one at all. Death of Superman has been, and now 20 years later, I can imagine will always be one of my favorite comic stories of all time. I was already a big fan of Superman. I was already collecting all the books, and had for years complained that I wished more people paid attention to them because I was reading Jurgens and Ordway and Byrne before that. And loving these books, loving what kind of long-term plan they had. And they had already introduced the triangle numbers, etc. And then Death of Superman came up, and all of a sudden everyone's like, have you heard about this? Have you read Superman? It's so cool. So there were ups and downs, of course, in the story. As I've said before, if you didn't tear up with Ma and Pa Kent in Funeral for a Friend, there's something wrong with you inside.
Well, not to just talk so much about the storyline, though I do think that the reason it worked was because the storyline was good enough, and because people who purchased it then continued to buy it, because the story quality was there. But really, I want to talk more about the significance in the industry. I mean, DC at the time was lagging behind Image and Marvel, and Valiant was nipping at their heels, and Dark Horse actually was too. They were not such a big player. This really was a game changer for them. And it was a game changer for the entire industry because we had already seen the great sales of X-Men. But this is where there's good and bad to Death of Superman. It created a lot of interest. It was the first time I ever recall seeing actual media coverage on a large scale of any sort of comic book event. On the other hand, even though we had the collectors collecting X-Men, New X-Men Volume 2, Number 1, that was people that were already collecting comic books who were being collectors. This brought in new collectors. This brought in people, those people who started buying all the number ones and who created the boom. This series did that. And this series then maybe is also responsible for, in some ways, for the downfall of the industry as well. So I think that this is the event is not just the storyline, or whether or not that worked, because it did. The event is much bigger than that. Brett, what do you think?
I think I was buying Superman prior to the death, and I do remember thinking that it was amongst the best comics available on the market. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. The sheer pandemonium that resulted from Superman actually dying was a great thing for the industry. It's unfortunate, I think, almost that the end result wasn't necessarily how they originally had planned. And so I think that you know, with the four different Supermans and stuff like that, that it almost opened up a different can of worms than DC was fully anticipating at the time. And then, I mean, at least they only did, you know, a few covers for that issue. I mean, it wasn't quite as they didn't get quite as bad into the crazy covers from that. But I mean, I think more so than anything, it was a great book and it was at a great time.
Chris, what do you think?
I think it was a great run. As far as it bringing down the downfall, no, it was simply the imitators that caused the downfall. Just because something works once doesn't mean you should repeat it. It worked once. It did set a bad template for future comic books, but I can't blame that single storyline for anything. It was a great run.
It's cause and effect, though. You know what I mean? It is, Chris, that you could argue it was the best thing ever for the industry. You could also argue it was the worst, though, because the industry really, in many ways, didn't have the maturity to handle what the industry became coming out of this. Keith, what do you think?
Well, I mean, the two long-term effects of Death of Superman were the real peak of the speculator boom, because Death of Superman within hours that thing was going for, you know, 10 times cover, and then a week later it was going for $100. It was ridiculous because there was so much interest in it. So many people that weren't comic readers were coming in because some of them just wanted to read the thing, which is awesome. A lot of them had heard it went to $40 and bought it at $40 because they thought it would go to $100. And that, there was a great phrase I heard the other day in an otherwise incredibly lousy article in the Wall Street Journal about comics that referred to that time as the Dutch tulip phase of comics. And that was exactly what it was. It was such a bubble. And it started there. It started a little before then with Image. That had started a bit of this trickle of massive, massive prices for these number ones and for these certain specific issues. We had first appearance of Venom was already going for quite a lot. And supply and demand doesn't quite work that way. And the flip side is that the one long-term effect of Death of Superman that pretty much always gets ignored, that actually makes those kinds of $100 an issue prices nearly impossible now, came out of this. The trade paperback became mainstream. Death of Superman still is the best-selling trade paperback ever. It's up to like the 14th or 15th print or something. This thing's always going to be available. I mean, this Death of Superman has more trade paperbacks in print than Watchmen. I mean, try to get your head around that. But the availability of the trade paperback means that I am never going to be that desperate for an issue, even without digital. I'm never going to be that desperate for a print copy that I'll pay $100 an issue anymore. And those two things, I think, kind of balance.
How do you think the rest of the industry then, and DC itself then, responded, Keith, to the death of Superman?
They killed Hal Jordan, which I think was awesome, but it wasn't necessarily that well received. And then they killed Oliver Queen, which didn't quite work because they just threw him out of an airplane or something like that. Death became something. I mean, it was interesting. Death of Superman became such a huge story, but it was never intended to be a long storyline. As Brett alluded to, the storyline was actually supposed to wrap up in Adventures of Superman 700? Was that the?
I think it was 700. Yeah.
Yeah, which actually became the introduction of the Reign of Superman storyline. That was supposed to be the ending. The storyline was only supposed to last a couple of months. And the reason for the delay between Funeral for a Friend and that issue was actually to revamp the plans and get new stories created. Which is why they brought in, Carl Kiesel came out at that point. It was Ordway's finale. It was when Ordway was supposed to leave. He did leave. He did the Adventures of Superman number 700, which was supposed to be where the character came back to life. This story ended up stretching over months longer than that. Because it had been such a big deal, they basically everyone looked at each other and said, we had no idea this was going to be such a big story. Now it seems kind of stupid to just wrap it up in a couple of months because it seems like such a cop-out to just, but it was only intended to be a short story. But it made deaths so saleable. And it's funny that, that the guys from Malibu had said that too. That's one of the things that consistently sells books is to kill the main character. And, it still works. But I mean, Death of Superman we talked about it cheapening death in comics. But it wasn't supposed to be uncheap, I guess. Hal Jordan was killed almost immediately, and this idea, all the legacy characters that were brought in really came out of Death of Superman. I mean, it was a bit of the model was in Barry Allen dying in Crisis, but I mean, really more affected by Death of Superman. And the idea that you could generate several new characters at times out of killing off one character that wasn't necessarily working.
How did you see the other publishers respond to the Death of Superman, Chris?
Not well. I mean, everybody started trying to get these big events going, and quite frankly, none of the storylines were that good. The worst probably being from DC itself, when they broke the bats back. Nightfall. What a horrible story. Didn't make a lick of sense.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. Nightfall was certainly a disappointment. But even more than that, the follow-up. The idea that they had to match Superman, that also the follow-up when they replaced Batman for the first time there. At least the first time in the modern era. That nobody liked, and the choice of who replaced him. John Paul Valley. There you go. But you know what? I'm gonna put it this way, Brett. Now I'll get you to respond to this. I saw the death of Superman like Star Wars was great. I love Star Wars. Star Wars created the idea of a blockbuster movie, and we still get the blockbuster movie instead of the movie. Death of Superman is the equivalent to Star Wars. It created the blockbuster comic book event. And they're still trying to do the blockbuster comic book event. Do you think there's any correlation there?
Well, I mean, I think there is. I think when you come out with something that is just so enormous, then you're always going to set the standard for what people will try to do next. The interesting thing, though, is as we're talking about it, we're talking about all these DC events, and I'm sitting here listening to you guys, and I'm thinking to myself, what was Marvel doing right there? And you know what? I don't remember.
Didn't they kill Reed Richards?
I think so.
Let me go there. They killed Reed Richards. Maximum Carnage. They stripped Wolverine of his adamantium.
Yeah, and I mean, none of those are, well, Maximum Carnage for sure, but...
Well, they said that Peter Parker, who has been Spider-Man for 30 years, is not actually Peter Parker.
Yeah,
that was a massive thing.
That was about 2 years later. The Spider-Man we knew wasn't actually Spider-Man. That was their reaction. The clone saga was their attempt to create a Spider or a Death of Superman event for Spider-Man. It never got the media coverage, and the storyline sucked ass. But it was certainly an attempt. Wolverine having his adamantium ripped out, you may forget now, that was big. I believe that was Wolverine 75, issue 75?
75, yeah.
That was a big deal. Chris,
I will note that was a good story arc, though.
I'm not saying it wasn't. There was Larry Hama, I believe. But I'm not saying it wasn't, but I am saying that it was the same idea. It was, oh my God, we can't just tell a good story anymore. We have to do something that's going to grab people's attention. The blockbuster comic book event. Something that's going to become collectible and get people buzzing. And then, of course, we also had all the covers. Chris, what do you think of the covers that started to, around this era, really go to the next, to the next level?
I remember bitching when they came out to you guys about the covers. I hated the covers when they started because they upped the price of my individual issues. The only cover I remember and liking was Exo Manowar. I thought that shiny cover was pretty neat. But on a whole, I hated the era of shiny covers. Just despised it.
Well, quickly, what's everyone's least favorite gimmick cover and most favorite gimmick cover? I actually have two gimmick covers on the wall of my my office at home. So, you know, there were ones that I really loved.
All right, go. You go first then.
Well, it was Jason Goes to Hell comic book adaptation, glow-in-the-dark cover of Jason's Mask. I got that on my wall. I loved all glow-in-the-dark covers. I had a collection at one point of about 20 of them. Like every glow-in-the-dark cover that came out. Chick Magnet, I tell you. And just at the recent show, I got Mark Texiera to sign a Ghost Rider glow-in-the-dark cover for me. Those were my favorites. I love those. My least favorite, Tyvek. Continuity Comics, the supposedly indestructible comic cover that was made out of Tyvek, which is the material used to wrap houses during the construction phase to keep them weatherproof before the siding goes up. As it happens, they were not saleable as a special item. We had tons of them left at the store, and we did experiment in how indestructible they were.
Brett, do you have any favorite, least favorite gimmick covers?
Well, I have a couple of least favorite ones. I think there was a Fantastic Four issue around that time. I believe it was 375 or something like that. And basically, it was just like a silver foil cover with everybody in like a black and white underneath. And it was just shiny. It was just pointless and shiny. There was no, like, it wasn't like it was lenticular. It wasn't like it was anything special. It was literally just shiny and lame. And then I really hated a lot of the die cut covers because, as a collector of looking for any kind of value in a comic book, a die-cut cover, the second that you put it out on the shelf, it's just like, oh, I just ripped it.
Oh, I don't know how many of those friggin' Wolverine issues that, with the slash marks across the cover that I marked down because they were torn.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those things were terrible. I love the glow-in-the-dark ones. I totally remember the Ghost Rider one that you're talking about. That you got text assigned.
There was a Sandman one as well.
That's right.
I got that one on my wall as well.
Yeah, but I actually really liked the holograms. I thought that the holograms looked very nice on the covers. They were not a particularly good add-on because they're just this little, like, oh, look, it's a hologram stuck on the corner of the book. But I thought they were neat looking.
You know, those holograms in, like, Wolverine 75, for instance. Around, I believe that month, every single comic book from X-Books had that hologram. Those holograms were great. Those holograms were at a next level. The quality of those holograms and the 3D effect was something remarkable.
Oh, and I think Spider-Man did them too, and they were just, the depth in them was amazing.
Yeah, but
yeah,
not
it,
every...
Yeah, it was during, right around the Clone Saga time. They were doing new costumes or something for Spider-Man.
Yeah, and that these holograms were just remarkable. But I saw some really crappy holograms on comic books too. These were the exception. You remember what was there? Were the Darkstalkers and Blade and everything like that? That line at the time, what was it called again?
The
Midnight
Suns.
Midnight Suns.
They had these black covers with this kind of.
Oh yeah, the blood. kind of
motif. Lame. That was awful. So you had definitely some really crappy ones. Lenticular, was that the ones that, like Exo Manivore that is number zero, issue zero that Chris was talking about? Was that one of those ones?
Well, Lenticular are the ones where if you shift them one way, you get one image, and then if you shift them another, the image will change.
So I guess these were just aluminum foil then, almost like a foil type cover that they had on the Exo Manivore.
I believe they just called it a foil cover.
Yeah, those were cool. Those were cool. You know what I liked, and I don't know where they did it first. I think it might have been Lobo and Superman, or it might have been during the crossover with the Milestone comics. But they had the ones. Remember those little things you used to be able to do your own scene, like in those little books.
Oh yeah.
Man of Steel had one. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. You could create your own like little fight scene. You have Superman punching Lobo or something like that, and have a foot of pow on there. It was a cover like that based on those. You used to get those books as a kid and play with them. So I love that.
Yeah, I mean that was one of those cases where you definitely had to get more than one because you had to play with it.
I mean, you had to get one to keep closed and one to open to one to play with. You wanted to play with that, so that was a lot of fun.
But yeah, those foil covers though that were on the X-Men books around the time with all the, you know, where they bookended those big events. No, not those ones, but the ones.
That one was lame though, where it was just like a stripe with like this aluminum thing, but it didn't do anything. And that was, I believe, what was the name of the disease that X-Men had?
Legacy virus.
Yeah, the legacy virus, and they had some sort of just in the middle of nowhere for some month. They had just had every X book shipped with this line, this almost hologram, but it wasn't. It was nothing. It was just a reason to put an extra price on the book. The worst one, I think, it was like War Machine number 17, where like seriously, like he changed from having like six guns to 12, and they put a new cover on a foil cover on to celebrate that. And it was like that was where it jumped the shark for me. I'm like, this isn't a big enough deal for a special cover that's going to cost me more money. That was it. So it definitely got me crazy.
Do you remember the Avengers cover where they reintroduced Vision as the white version?
Or from the white version to the red?
Well, no, he went red and then he went to the white version.
No, but they reintroduced him the other way, didn't they? Maybe I'm getting it backwards. I thought they reintroduced the Vision. He was white for a long time. And reintroduced him about this era into their yellow and red and green.
No, he started off red.
Well, he started green. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he went white.
John Byrne made him white, though. Yeah, John Byrne made him white.
And they reintroduced him the other way, Chris.
Yeah, I just remember when they introduced him in the white character, they had him on the cover in metallic gold, which was the wrong color anyway. but it supposedly looked cooler than having him white on the cover. That was the high water mark for me. I remember thinking specifically, I'm done with these gimmick covers.
Yeah, that's what I thought with the War Machine one.
Some of the books just did them so much. Like, it just seemed like every 2 months
Marvel
you had a gimmick cover. Yeah.
Marvel was the company that, to me, that made it from, instead of to signify something, made it from, let's try and grab more sales with it. Like, they were the company, to me, that went too far with it, personally. So, to all this.
There's a Fantastic Four being, like, probably the worst offender.
Well, yeah. That,
well, like I say, that one stupid cover was just... was just ridiculous. It was just pointless.
The
thing
was, DeFalco's the editor-in-chief, and that's the book he's writing. A book he's writing, right? So it's no coincidence. It's no coincidence at all. So let's get back into this. Now DC's taken off. Marvel is trying to create event books. Image is starting to lose a little bit of their steam because they've had so many late projects about this time that some of their fans have started to leave a little bit because Superman and X-Men and these other books are creating events as well. And Valiant had really started to drop, unfortunately, about this time. They did those aluminum foil covers. That was cool. But they were the momentum they had was starting to shift downwards. So Valiant and Image came together on possibly the worst crossover event in the history of comics. Keith, since you're the one laughing,
I would say the second worst intercompany crossover that has ever happened. Because I gotta say that even though it was Jurgens, Marvel vs. DC is the worst one that I've ever read.
Well,
that's so much jazz for that series, and it was so awful.
Can I actually just make one quick point? Mm-hmm. I had to make fun of my friend Chris, who is on Twitter as Comic Canuck, because he actually went so far as to contact Diamond, phone comic stores, look on Amazon, because he is desperate to find a hardcover version of the Marvel vs. DC crossover. And he said that to me, and I looked at him like, really? Really? You wanted that?
But, well, we will get there. We will get there, but because we're talking
Death
about
Mate. We're talking Deathmate right now, though.
Say what you will about Marvel versus DC, they all at least came out.
Yeah, that's true.
Deathmate.
Yeah.
I believe it was published as Prologue 08.
And then, what was there a 0.0 in there too?
And I think there might have been actually a double zero issue. And I don't know how you sort 0 and 00 in order. more power to you if you can.
And then they did it by colors as well. Don't forget that.
Yes, and it was red, blue. Well, yes, because there were four books. Two of them were supposed to be published by Image, and two of them published by Valiant. And it was red, blue, green, and yellow, I think.
No, there was a black as well.
Was there a black? Okay. Sure. Black. So there was a prologue and an epilogue, and I think it was a zero. Maybe it wasn't a zero.
And if you'll
and
recall,
four books in the middle that don't necessarily go in a I think it was about 6 months between pieces of this.
Well, shocker of shockers, the two books from Image didn't ship on time. Valiant did their job.
Ah, yes, the blissful world where there are no editors.
Valiant had their trouble too, because you have these books and you're shipping them, and the company you're working with is screwing up the project. I believe it was Black and Red that was Image's responsibility, and I believe Red was in fact Liefeld's company, because I believe that they were. I can't remember who did the Black one, but that might have been Valentino. Or Silvestri, but I believe that, yeah, I mean, the red one, I believe, was Liefeld, and that was the worst offender. And it just killed this crossover, which fans were geeked for. You have to understand, when this was announced, this was the thing that potentially could have been for these guys, put them back up front. Like, Image could have overtaken DC and Marvel again. Valiant could have boomed back up. They were really, really... the fanboy love for this was ready to go through the roof. Then it didn't ship, and it sucked. Chris, what do you think of? What do you think? What are your thoughts or memories of that?
I'm still waiting for my issues, guys.
I'm pretty sure that was before us, but I'm not 100% sure. Although I think some of it came out afterwards.
I think so. It was just a mess.
I think we might be waiting for some of the issues, come to think of it.
Better call Diamond. You know what? And the thing is, Image was hurt by it, but not as bad. I think this event was the death nail in Valiant, and they didn't last too much longer after this. Anybody else agree with this?
I think you're right. If Valiant had, if their next new books had been any good... Because I believe after this, they launched a title called Armorines.
Ninjak, I believe, came.
They released a whole bunch of, like, really average titles.
And if they had
the
a really good title in there, they could have recovered. But
yeah, the
Visitor,
those
titles really sucked.
Yeah, that's the thing. It really was. The company all of a sudden looked like a company that was trying to create an event and match the big boys instead of a company that was... doing the quality work that they had been doing. That's how I remember it. Now, another thing that was coming about this time was Dark Horse decided to launch its own superhero line, just as Malibu had done with Ultraverse, with Comics Greatest World. Chris, we're going to you on this one.
Okay, I collected all these books, and I loved all these books to a certain amount. But the universe didn't hold together. Yeah, I believe they had four quadrants of this universe. Steel City, a greedy universe, and futuristic city, and even reading all the books, I could never make a cohesive sense of this universe. But without this attempt at creating a coherent universe, we wouldn't have the epic movie named Barbed Wire.
That's right.
And Pamela Anderson wouldn't have that barbed wire tattoo?
Yes, that's right. And I would have seen
the
her breast.
The world would be less without this particular attempt at a comic book universe. That's the line I'm going with.
And I would have one less place to see her breasts, which would not have been good. So let's... Brett.
And they did launch with a Frank Miller cover. That was as much talent as they had on the line.
It was really a disappointment because the book I was most interested in was a Stephen Grant book that he wrote called X. But this was just, it was pretty early on that I realized that the only book that was of quality and was going to survive was Ghost. So, Brett, what did you think of Comics Greatest World?
I read about three of them. It was enough to tell me that there was really no interest in the line. And I don't know, I haven't read another one since. That was pretty much it. You know, about three books. That's it. Boom.
All right. Yeah, no, just a disappointment. So,
I just wanted to make one point, though, about, and it even harkens back to the whole Death of Superman idea. And it's the concept that so many people, after seeing the Death of Superman and seeing the sales and seeing the concept that if you could bring the fans in immediately, then you could try to keep them. So they did keep extending the storylines. And Marvel was very guilty of that. But I think that you even saw that in some of these other companies as well. Just these extensive storylines that would take place over so many places. Even like in the same book, but also the crossovers. And I mean, I know that we're gonna have to talk about some of the big crossovers that come up, but I really think that the Death of Superman started that whole element of like, well, you know, if we can keep him for one, let's try to keep him for 30 idea.
Yeah, you know what? I think this is one of the areas that Malibu had a problem with, that they had created this universe and there was a lot of continuity in between it. But then they went into Breakthrough. Then they went into these events like that that made them, now they look like they were trying to follow the success of the other companies, intercompany crossovers. And I felt like maybe all of a sudden it started to feel forced. And it started to feel like the quality wasn't quite there. And the company-wide crossover wasn't always needed. And whereas the continuity between the books was good, the company-wide crossover that I thought Malibu with Breakthrough started to get into, and they had another major one as well. I can't recall its name, but yeah, I thought that was a mistake that they made. But of course, talking about those big company events, nothing that you could talk about more than DC, who had taken over and they were number one, and then they fell back down behind Marvel. But they were really, really close now. They weren't far behind. They're ahead of Image, behind Marvel. They decided to do another big event. And I'm still, to this day, trying to figure out if they did Zero Hour to do sales, to relaunch the universe and clean up some continuity, to...
introduce a whole bunch of new characters?
To shock people again. We'll create that event with Hal Jordan. Like, I still, to this day, don't understand what the purpose was of Zero Hour. Chris, what did you think might have been the purpose of Zero Hour?
I like Starman. The purpose is, I think they were just used to doing a yearly crossover, and somebody looked at the calendar and said it was time. Well, we got to straighten this out. We do this every year. Let's try to fix stuff. And there wasn't really that much to fix, or it was the wrong way to fix it anyway, really a waste of time for a crossover. There was no reason to do it, and I think it stands an appropriate place in comic book history.
You know, the funny thing is, it was written and drawn by Dan Jurgens, I believe, and I think the actual miniseries is good. I think all the zeros that came out after it and the role it played in the universe, sucked. And, of course, the Hal Jordan thing, again, it's still a head-scratcher to this day. Brett, your thoughts on Zero Hour?
Well, I mean, Marvel and DC had both been doing a lot of the crossovers with annuals before, like where they were telling a lot of
like
stories.
Bloodlines.
Like Bloodlines, yeah. All the Atlantis attacks in Marvel, you know, a lot of them where all the annuals would tie together. And that seemed fairly reasonable to
a
certain degree.
DC did a whole Elseworlds? Every annual was an Elseworlds?
Yeah.
Love that.
That's
one.
Good stuff. That was great.
And Zero Hour really struck me as along the same lines, only this time it was going to be with absolutely everything. And you did have everything in it. You had some characters that were kind of rebooted. You had some characters that were brand new starting up. You had some, you know, you had old characters that you were just telling a sort of new origin tale on. You had some characters that were really just telling the same origin story on, or not an origin story at all. I think they missed the point of what Zero Issues are actually intended to do. And ultimately, yeah, the miniseries was pretty solid. The rest of it was just...
So you're saying we didn't need the 47th origin of Batman? We had already gotten it?
If they even bothered telling it. I mean,
They did something like that. Let me tell you what came good out of this. Starman, which Chris
mentioned. Starman, absolutely.
Hitman, and the short-lived but awesome Primal Force by Steven Seagal. Seagal, I hope I'm
Seagal,
right.
I would say. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to call him Seagal, so, you know, didn't want to make that mistake. But the Primal Force, which was awesome, and had the best, most interesting take on one of my favorite characters, Red Tornado, ever. Keith, Zero Hour, go.
If you guys don't start talking about how damage was created out of this crossover, the boy who explodes, I'm walking off.
He already exists.
That's true.
Was he around?
No,
already,
he was around before this.
Yeah, I think he was.
Here, I'll give you a little backstory. He was around before this. His series was awesome, but
for
not
like
selling
four
at
issues.
All. Yeah, well, that's well, no, but it was terrific. That first issue might be the best first issue in the history of comic books for a new character, at least in the last 25 years. It was awesome, but it wasn't selling. So what they did was they decided to try and give him a little bit of cachet and importance in the universe by having him play such a big role in Zero Hour, trying to create sales and give some buzz to his book, which failed.
Well, I think the biggest thing of Zero Hour is, I mean, as Chris said, they were doing a big crossover every year. They had done Crisis, Legends, Millennium, there was War
Gods
of the Gods.
Yeah.
I mean, they had essentially done, you know, with only a year or two different, year or two missed, a big crossover every year. And part of the goal of Zero Hour was to tidy up some of this continuity, and it was actually to relaunch some books. You know, it's funny right now, one of the rumors of what's going to happen with DC in September is a zero month, a month where you can retell some of these origins, clean up some of the continuity, you know, reintroduce some characters in a different way. That's what they were doing. And some it worked, like Mo was saying, and some it doesn't. Because, I mean, Superman, you don't have to tell his origin again. They introduced basically a villain from his childhood. Batman was a bridging sequence between John Paul Valley and Dick Grayson being Batman. So it was four issues of Bruce Wayne as Batman for a month, and then Dick Grayson takes over. It's a bit odd. One of the biggest impacts was on Legion of Superheroes, which actually spent months heading toward the Zero Hour crossover and wrapped up, Legion 5 years later, all collects up into one of the best finales I've seen in a comic. I love the way that the Legion 5 years later arc ends. It's an incredible ending involving the Time Trapper and everything that had been in Legion for decades. And then launched it from the Zeros being a reintroduction of a completely rebooted Legion of Superheroes in a way that hadn't been done in Legion with Crisis. Legion wasn't one of the books that rebooted with Crisis. And, there was a lot of this leading toward and leading away, but not all of the books worked. I mean, it didn't necessarily wasn't needed in some books. You know, Hawkman needed some cleanup for sure. That was probably the one that was most affected by Zero Hour. So it was a bit of jack of all trades. I can't figure out what exactly they were doing with Hal Jordan other than, you know, making the Hal Jordan fans madder and madder. I mean, for me, I was happy with him just gone. Having Parallax be such a big part of Zero Hour was an odd thing.
Anybody have any idea of what they thought was the worst book? I mean, I hated Fate because, I mean, and it had a good writer. I can't remember, what's his name? Guy did Doom 2099, I believe, was the writer for it. What, anybody recall?
John Francis Moore?
Yeah, it was John Francis Moore.
Yeah, so I thought it would be good, but you just, I mean, he was no longer Dr. Fate. He was a guy named Fate, and it was awful.
And retconned out pretty fast. I mean, that was never mentioned again. Yeah, that series lasted about a year or so.
Another character I thought was terrible that debuted in Bloodlines that got its own series out of this. I think this was actually the worst book, even worse than Fate, was Anima. It was just terrible. Anybody else have any idea of what was the worst?
I actually didn't like Primal Force. At all.
Really?
No,
wow.
I really, really didn't like that book.
Wow, but what about how cool Red Tornado was?
I actually agree with Keith and Mo on this one. Hated Primal Force, loved the take of the rusted out Red Tornado. I thought that was the take they should take with that character, but the actual Primal Force as a comic book sucked.
Now, I haven't read it in 15 years, but my vague memory of Primal Force is, you've got earth powers, I've got water powers, we should hang out. Hey, there's a guy with fire powers, like it.
Brett, you liked Primal Force.
You know, I think I did, but again, I haven't read it in 15 years. I mean, I liked a lot of things 15 years ago.
Well, you know what, we're setting up a retro review. That'll be coming in the next few weeks. Of course, there's a lot of stuff we say that's coming we never get around to because we get so many damn good ideas. But I'm on this one. Retro review. All right,
As long as Primal Force isn't as long as some of the other ones. I tried reading the Deathstroke Zero issue, and I'm like, oh my lord, is this a novel?
Yeah, no kidding. So let's move on here, because we talked a little bit about one company crossover, and we hinted at it, so even though we're a little bit chronologically out here, I think we're going to have to go out in this episode talking about this part of the 90s, talking about the great, finally we got it, DC and Marvel. Chris, what did you think of DC and Marvel? They finally got together.
Wolverine should never fight Lobo.
Wolverine beat Lobo.
That was the worst fight. That still pisses me off completely. But let's actually talk about the series and not get into the minutiae of the fight.
Well, I have to say this on the fight. For those of people who don't know, DC and Marvel put the characters up for a fan vote who would win the fights. So they had like Hulk versus Superman. Lobo, who was so popular at the time, though his popularity is starting to fade, because he was overused by DC, and we can get into that a little bit. This is another thing that came in the 90s. A hot character bumps sales in one book, so now he's on the cover and starts crossing over lots of books to the point where his character no longer means anything. Lobo was the worst of that, but not the only one. Who else were you saying? Keith?
Batman,
a great example.
Yeah, it's a good thing that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, I know. They dodged that bullet in the new 52.
Yeah, well, but Lobo,
I believe he's in the Birds of Prey now, isn't he?
You would be the only one who'd know, I think.
But, so they put these characters up. So you had Storm versus Wonder Woman. I think if Storm took on Wonder Woman today, Wonder Woman would win. But back then, Storm won. Not because she would actually win in a fight, but because she was more popular. So Lobo and Wolverine went at each other. But I don't think any of the company have any sort of, how would you describe it? They didn't want either one of these guys to lose publicly. So what they did was they had them drinking together at a bar, and they continued drinking while they fade down below the bar and keep on fighting. So you don't actually physically see it. Like, it's just the two of them fighting as they go down lower and lower, continue drinking and fighting behind this bar. It was like the worst thing ever. And then they had other characters that they decided who would win. So Aquaman beat Namor, which I love Aquaman. as much as the next guy. Well, actually, I don't, but I'm fine with Aquaman as next as the next guy. He wouldn't beat Namor in a fight. I mean, let's be honest. So there was a lot of crazy stuff. But anyways, Peter David wrote part of this. All right, let's move on. Chris, talk a little more about it now that I've kind of gone off the rails.
Yes. No, I think the fan vote for this series was probably a mistake. They turned it into a fight book, and although fights are an important part of this, fans actually wanted to see these characters interact. We wanted a story, and there wasn't one. It just turned into, who do you think would win in a fight? And we do that on our own as comic fans. We don't need the comic companies necessarily to do it for us. We want, as a fan, I wanted a story out of that one. And there was no story. It was just a series of 4 or 5 page fights, as I remember. Wolverine versus Lobo being the worst, and I believe the writer got the fan vote and going, okay, Wolverine's more popular. How do I make this work? Let's do it off screen. I'm pretty sure that's how that went down. Really succeeded on none of the promise. I mean, you get the great characters from Marvel and DC, and you do nothing with it. What a waste of time.
Yeah, serious fight between Superman and Hulk, people would want to see. The fight they gave us, nobody wanted to see. Hey, Brett, just so you know, Primal Force went 15 issues, including the Zero, that you will be reading. Now, talk about Marvel and DC.
Honestly, what I remember about Marvel and DC was that sheer fact that it was like 4 issues of 4-page fights. I mean, this was like pro wrestling. I mean, there was and with less story. It was just like a big fat battle royal, and there was no real purpose behind it. I think they might have tried to put a bridging story on it, but I mean, it's never been one of those things. For something that was so, you know, groundbreaking and important at the time, it's a book that I've never gone back to read, and I've never had the desire to go back to read it, because I think they dropped the ball on it so badly. And this is the kind of thing that I would think that fans should be really interested in, being like, oh, Marvel and DC teamed up. They did a big, you know, fight book and stuff like that. I should want to read that. I don't.
Keith, go ahead.
Every comic fan, young and old, plays the game at some point of, what if Superman and Hulk had a fight? Who would win? The most important part of this debate is that you don't have an answer. Because as soon as you have an answer, it's concrete and someone's right and someone's wrong. And that's all this book was like deciding that there is a real winner between these two random characters. What was the, does anyone remember the name of the character who was introduced, the one that actually bridged the two universes?
Was it Axis?
Oh. Axis, that's correct. And then the sequel was called All Access, Marvel DC All Access. Axis is a unique character, and we talk about the convoluted nature of whether you're going to use a character or not again. Axis is joint owned between Marvel and DC, making it the hardest character to do anything. Marvel Man will get a trade paperback before Axis is used again.
Which is too bad, because, you know, the fans are really screaming for Axis to come back.
Well, I know one that would be, so.
That's true, right. Comic Canuck. How you doing, you toolbox?
To be clear, is he wishing there was one, or is there really one that he's trying to find? I actually don't need to know the answer to that.
Well, apparently there is a big giant 512-page hardcover of all the ones that occurred before that point. That's volume 1. So I know that he's hoping for volume that has the 4 issues plus the amalgam. Yeah.
Superman, Spider-Man, was it Batman, Hulk?
I'd like to find that, too, because my table here needs a book underneath it to keep it from shaking.
It'll be way too big a book, honestly. I mean, with the amalgam books in there and stuff like that, there's really...
You're better off just... amalgam books.
Okay, we're going to get to that next. That will be the next... start picking up the next part. We'll be talking about amalgam and all of a sudden... all the crossovers that were occurring between Marvel and DC and their characters, because they started getting, you know, Green Lantern and Silver Surfer and Galactus and Darkseid together and stuff like that. So we'll go into that, and that'll be Amalgam, and that moving on next time. Did you finish talking about it, Keith? I think you did.
I think I've said enough.
All right, so we'll be getting into that. We'll be picking up that in part three, as well as talking about Defiant, the death of Valiant and the purchase by Acclaim, more about Image and where what it evolved into. So we get into all that in part three. But first, next off, we're going to talk about our reviews, saving you from bad comics, Keith.
Here I come to save the day.
Saving you from bad comics.
Brett. There you go. Brett, why don't you open up with your first review? WeView.
Well, I'll start off with one of the new books for this week. I'm going to start off with The Ravagers. So we have a spinoff of Teen Titans, a book which I'm not reading. You have Fairchild from Gen 13, a book which I did read. She's pretty much nothing like that. And I'm just really impressed with the fact that they brought Howard Mackey out of hiding to write a book again. It's just a shame that his skills haven't improved in the space and time that I have last noted him. I thought that Ravagers was a piece of crap. This is a book that does so much that we've seen before that I didn't want to see it again. And I think the weirdest thing is that it really strikes me as too early in the whole 52 process to be spinning off other books from a series. It's just, you know, it's just not really, it's not very well written, it's not very well drawn, and in my opinion, it's just a really bad starting point, so I would have no interest in reading it again.
You know, it's, Brett, I don't think it's that his skills haven't improved, it's that they eroded. I mean, I enjoyed his work on Spider-Man. I enjoyed his Ghost Rider. I also didn't enjoy this. I think Ian Churchill is a good artist, but you know the art didn't blow me away. Certainly, what gets me is I'm not reading Teen Titans. Shocker, being published by DC. I'm not reading Teen Titans, so I'm wondering the stuff that where this opens. It feels like it's issue three, and I don't know what happened in issue one and two, and I don't know if there's a zero or it's because this occurred where Fairchild breaks these characters out of this torture prison that they're in. I don't know if that happened in Teen Titans. I don't know where that happened. So I'm just sitting here wondering, I'm like, shouldn't I have gotten this other stuff so I'd know the characters and the settings and why they're so angry and this and that? It's really, it's not well done at all. The other thing is, you mentioned it, Brett, she is not fair the Fairchild people know. This means that Gen 13, if people are hoping for that to return, will never return. It's just another character that they revamped that was popular already the way it was and not necessarily better now. Keith, what did you think of it?
This is perhaps the worst comic I've read this year. I woke up early this morning so I could hate it more. I read this yesterday and then, you know, started drinking, hoping that those specific brain cells would be the one I killed off. Just a painful book. And you know, I have been following DC. I gave up on Teen Titans a while back. So I have a vague idea of what's going on. I know it's coming out of a crossover, but instead of being launched into the crossover, it feels like the next part of a crossover that, you know, isn't marked on the cover. I don't know. It was just complete nonsense to me. I have no idea what's supposed to be happening. Can't follow any of the characters. The new characters I found not engaging in the least. Yeah, this is, I'm going to say I'm good.
If Beast Boy just got completely ignored this issue, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, I forgot that he was in the book.
Here's a character I know. Oh, that's not use him. Chris, what do you think?
Boy, you guys are full of love, aren't you? Yeah, I have to agree. It didn't work. I wasn't looking forward to this book, but when I opened it up and saw the lineup, I was like, oh, Beast Boy, cool. Fairchild, cool. I love Gen 13. And then I read 21 pages, and it didn't make any sense. And then, and I didn't think this was possible. I really didn't think this was possible. they have introduced in this issue Warblade again to the DC Universe, and he actually looks worse than he originally did. I didn't think that was possible. I thought he was the worst character-looking character ever created over an image, and they've made him look worse in this book. I'm not willing to put all the blame on Howard Mackey here. I don't think he was given a lot to work with. Yeah, I think just this book, its launch was an editorial misstep. I'm not willing to degrade my Howard Mackey memories for this book, but really god awful.
There's another character in this book that was fairly prominent in DC before the New 52. And that's Deathstroke's daughter, Rose. And she doesn't have a line in this book. She just kills somebody and is on like half the pages. But she doesn't say anything and has no characterization. And I don't know where she is or where she's coming from or where she relates to Deathstroke or any of this. I don't know. So
I think actually she does have a few lines, but they're always when she's off panel.
Oh, there you go.
So it makes no sense. I don't know who's talking, whether it's her or Warblade or somebody else, but it's almost invariably when she's off-panel that she's talking.
Chris, why don't you give us our next Weeb?
Alrighty. Let's go with the new Curtis Weeb book, Grim Reaper. Leaper, that is. Grim Leaper. I would offer some constructive criticism of this book. However, I was too busy jizzing in my pants. Loved every panel.
There's a pull quote for you, Curtis. I jizzed in my pants. Chris, we juggle.
Oh, he will be hearing about that. Trust me, I will make sure that he hears that was, you'll like that. Keith, what do you think of the book?
My pants are fine. I quite liked it. It is a mini series, so I kind of like the idea that this is a Finnit story. I looked at it and when I first read it, I wasn't sure. I thought it might be a regular, and when I found it as a mini, actually, I liked it more because I think it's the kind of story I do want to see as a package, as opposed to trying to go back to this well too often. Just a cool concept. I like the art. There's some cool deaths in this book. Playing around with some neat ideas. It's a bit of fun. It's not as deep as some of the other work that Weeb has done, but a fun book. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm in for the whole series.
Yeah, I have to admit to being a little disappointed with this book. I mean, I'm a big Weeb fan. I just, you know, I was pushing his book, Another World, here on the podcast a few episodes ago. I love Green Wake, love Peter Panzerfaust. But this, while I could put it alongside Green Wake in terms of tone to some degree, I just felt the pace was off. The pace was too slow for me. The characters were not likable for me. His dialogue is strong, but doesn't matter. The characters were completely unlikable for me, and it didn't feel as original to me. I felt like I've been down this story before, to some degree or not, even if it is a slightly different take. It didn't feel 100% original to me, so I won't be back. It's too bad, because I do like his work, but this just didn't do it for me personally. Brett, what do you think?
Well, I'm a little surprised to hear you say that, because I know what a big fan of Quantum Leap you are, so I just kind of assumed that this would have been right up your alley. But,
yeah, you see, the difference is Dr. Samuel Beckett is possibly the greatest, most heroic character I've ever known. A great character that I loved. This didn't have that.
Fair enough. Well, I wrote
hoping the next Leap will be the Leap Holmes stuck in my head when I was reading the book.
Oh, boy. But I did write a review on this for Comicosity, so for more information, you should definitely go there to read that. But overall, I loved the book. I thought that the art was fantastic. I loved the use of color in the book. I just thought that you know, it was a different collection of colors, but they all really fit nicely together. I definitely found it a light and fun book to read, which I didn't necessarily expect out of a book called Grim Leaper. But for me, you know, this was, and like you say, Keith, I am glad that it's only a 4-issue miniseries. I think that as a regular series, it probably wouldn't work as well, but as a miniseries, it's going to work much better. So, you know, big thumbs up for me.
Okay, did either, now I'm not asking this of Chris because he'll laugh at anything, but did Keith or Brett, some of the attempts at humor, which to me felt really flat and didn't make me laugh, but yet he tempted it many times, actual humor, actual out loud, make you laugh moments, did they work for any of you?
I think a couple of them did. There's a full-page splash that made me laugh. I don't want to give away this because it's a little later in the book. But yeah, there's a full-page splash that made me laugh.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of I think, really, really fun moments. I mean, I wasn't rolling in the aisles on it, but I was very happy with where it went.
All right, Brett, let's go on to another book.
Another book. Okay, well, I should be able to polish this off pretty quickly. We'll talk about Batman Inc. Now, Grant Morrison and Batman, you know, these are, wow, what used to be, you know, 20 years ago, these were two of my absolute favorite things. 2012 rolls around. Obviously, I didn't read Batman before, and I know it doesn't really tie too much into the Batman that's going on now, but wow, I don't like this book either. The writing is what it is. I really didn't like the art at all. To me, it totally doesn't work for what I expect Batman to look like, and thank you. Yeah, Angus doesn't like it either. But
Angus is not a fan.
Don't blame him. I, of course, had no concept of what was going on, and I certainly don't care to know what's going on because I will never read another issue of this again.
You know, I didn't read this, and I probably will, actually, but I didn't read this because, you know, Morrison, grr. New 52, grr. DC, grr. You know, I'm not pleased with it. Keith, go ahead.
I didn't like this.
Chris, go ahead.
Okay. I like this more than I expected to. I did not like the previous incarnation of Batman Inc. And this one I found myself, while not enjoying, tolerating. Not exactly a great review. I will say this. There's a huge, or supposedly huge, surprise ending. And after it, I thought, this probably means we won't get a spin-off of Bat-Cow. I really just wanted a spin-off of a character introduced in this book, Bat-Cow. I don't think we're going to get a spin-off named Bat-Cow.
That is a damn shame.
I don't even remember the ending. Like, I read it yesterday. I read it yesterday. I'm like, I don't remember the ending.
I read the book twice and I have no idea what Chris is talking about.
It had nothing to do with Bat-Cow. I just they were obviously going a different direction, and I wanted to go back to the Bat-Cow.
More Bat-Cow, we all agree.
The only cow that I want is the man-eating cow.
And for all your Damian Wayne needs, read Batman and Robin by Tomasi, because it's awesome.
All right, well, Chris, go on to give us our next book.
Okay, let's go do Godzilla. Godzilla from Dark Horse. It's relaunched once again. We have a fair amount of Godzilla mayhem happening in this book. And what else do you need? Chris loves the Godzilla. This was a Godzilla. It worked. There was nothing to find objectionable, but you really sort of have to like Godzilla to like this book.
Chris, what you're saying is giant green lizard, check. Mayhem, check. Check, check.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm saying. Giant spider. It works for me, but...
Check, check, check.
But I wouldn't give it to my mom.
Keith, what do you think?
She doesn't like Godzilla.
What do you think, Keith?
Just derailed thinking about Chris's mom.
You know how much I'd love to make a mom joke. You know how much I'd love to make a mom joke. But even I'm not going there anymore. Let's go, Keith.
I kind of like this. I mean, it felt a bit like Hard Boiled meets Godzilla, or Red meets Godzilla. Kind of the old Special Forces guy versus Godzilla. It's kind of a neat concept. It was fun. It's pretty light. I gotta be honest, if I forgot to pick up the second issue, I probably would never go back and grab them. But, you know, if I see the second issue, I might grab it. I'm kind of back and forth. It didn't stick with me as a lasting memory, though.
You know, you say it's pretty light, and it generally is, but there's a moment that isn't, and it's a significant moment in the story. I thought it was really well written, and it wasn't what I expected. I love Cloverfield as a movie. I was a big fan of Cloverfield. And this is a Cloverfield take on Godzilla, but with somebody who can actually kick ass in the role of the Cloverfield characters. So I enjoyed it, and I hope it continues like this going forward. I will be reading this.
Well, you know, like you, Mo, I was totally expecting nothing out of the book. Like, I was thinking, oh my lord, it's another Godzilla book. And honestly, after reading it, I just thought, wow, this is a bunch of fun. You know, I got characters that, you know, the main characters of the book are not Godzilla. You know, they're not the big giant monsters, which I thought was great. You know, you actually got the chance to really, you know, see people that are outside of it. Again, this is another one that I wrote up for Comicosity, but, you know, and I'm going to throw in Scree-onk, because Aaron just absolutely loved that, and he had to throw that in as part of the review. But Godzilla definitely is a good book. Good fun.
All right, Brett, one more.
Ah, Darth Vader and the Ghost Prison. Well, I finished this one just before we started recording. And I think the thing about the Star Wars comics is that, as a general rule, when I read them, I wind up enjoying them. And I always think to myself, man, I should go back and read some of those Star Wars comics. Perhaps start at the beginning and read through all 9 billion of them now. But there's something in my head that tells me that I don't have time to do that. This comic is a good story. I think that it's interesting, stuff like that. But again, my biggest problem with it comes at the end, and I'm not going to give anything away, but there's no possible way that you can do anything with it, because you already know that they're not going to be able to succeed in the mission that they're kind of that they have at the end. You know, it takes place, when is it that it takes place? Is it just before New Hope?
Between 3 and 4, yeah.
Yeah.
Not long after 3, is kind of...
Yeah. And so I think that because of, you know, 4, 5, and 6, you know that this is just a miniseries, and that it's not really going to add anything to the ultimate Star Wars canon. So I think that, you know, they kind of lose... The story loses something for me in that. But it was
pretty
good.
You don't know the particular lead character story arc, though.
No,
you
don't.
You think you know where it's going, and you know where Star Wars is going, but you don't know where this particular lead character story arc is going. What I liked about this was, all of a sudden, the evil empire has people in it who are just people. People who have families, who are, you know, normal people, who go to parties, who... They're very humanized in this. They're not just, hey... You know, we're evil. Like, there's a very humanizing factor to this. The art is nice, the writing is nice, but it doesn't matter if you don't read it. That's the problem with this book, I think. It just doesn't matter if you don't read it. And it's another book that has Darth Vader on the title that he has no lines and is barely in the book. Keith, what did you think?
Overall, I enjoyed this book. A little more than I expected. I've always found the Star Wars Dark Horse stuff a little hit and miss. Not a big fan of the stuff that takes place, you know, 1,000 years ago or whatever. 1,000 years before the long time ago. I kind of like the idea of playing with, like you were saying, Mo, a different perspective of the Empire from someone who's inside. There's a great bit of inner monologue early on in the issue where he talks about the time when the Jedi plotted against the Empire, and he talks about it in these very negative terms of, you know, how the sneaky Jedi almost took over everything, but luckily the Emperor was able to stop them. And it's just a different perspective on, you know, a pretty complex storyline that you have once you have the six films. So I don't know. I liked it. It's been a while since I read. You know, I was saying before we started recording that probably the last Star Wars story I tried that I really liked was Vader's Quest, which was quite a while ago. Which was I only read because it was Dave Gibbons' arc.
Chris, your thoughts?
I'm going to get some hell for this on Twitter, but I really don't like Star Wars comic books. Never have, but. This is the best one I've read. I thoroughly enjoyed this book. As Keith was saying, a completely, or maybe it was Mo that was saying, a completely different perspective on the Empire. I'm in for the second issue, and it's a Star Wars comic. I can't believe it.
Yeah, it was pretty good. It doesn't matter if you read it, but it's a pretty good story. You know what I mean? It is pretty good. Chris, let's go out with your final plugs.
My final plugs. I'm Chris at WeTalkPodcast.com, Chris_WeTalk on Twitter. I've got a cool blog on the Crippled Avengers over at WeTalk Comics. Brett.
All right. Well, I'm Brett_WeTalk. That's B-R-E-T-T. Brett at WeTalkPodcast.com. I just had my 10 tweets Thursday on Comicosity, so I think that's probably the last of us. But anyways, there's ongoing reviews, Godzilla, Mind Management, which I thought was one of my favorite books, maybe of the year, that I just reviewed. And anyways, that's about it for me for now, so moving on.
All right, I am Cub Reporter K on Twitter, and you can email me at keith@wetalkpodcast.com. And I recently put my op-ed, North Star Doesn't Know Who You Are Either, on WeTalkPodcast.com, and also I've written a couple of reviews, a couple that have just been posted on Comicosity, and a couple coming up. And yesterday, or this week, my review of Peter Panzerfaust number 4, the first time I've given a 10 out of 10 to a comic in reviewing for Comicosity. This issue just completely blew me away, and I can't remember the last time I said these words, but this is my favorite ongoing comic now. Mo.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm Mo, M-O, We Talk Podcast, or Mo_WeTalk. So, yeah, just one more time, a shout-out. Definitely check out Keith's blog. It was fantastic on North Star. Chris is on Crippled Avengers. Check out Brett's interview with We Talk Music, heavy metal, German band, heavy metal band, Lacuna Coil, sorry.
Coil.
Lacuna Coil. It was, yep. Terrific. Of course, like I say, We Talk Podcasts has some really interesting stuff coming up. We Talk Wrestling continues to kick ass all over the internet. Great blogs, great other stuff. But also, you definitely want to check out the Comic Podcast Network, of which we're now affiliated as well. So you can always go there. So thank you very much to everybody. I got to go write a wrestling blog, so we're OUT.